This is Chick Morgan, Dr. Chick Morgan, a cowgirl PhD diva, and I'm with my co-host,
Rodney Burseal,
the photographer in chief. And we want to welcome you to another episode of Passports, Please. Conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. And we are here on a For the Hill Country, a beautiful, chilly winter morning. And we are delighted to have Greg Davis, who we're all going to learn a lot more about. Because, you know, usually Rodney or I, we know something about the people that we're bringing in. And then I always do a deep dive research, you know, and look at all these articles. And there's some very interesting reasons why we don't have a lot of information.
I like that. It's intentional.
Right? Yeah. Made me a little suspicious, actually, Greg. Right. When I couldn't access any of these articles, but been seeing what you're doing and the big picture, so to speak, of what you're doing. This is going to be a really interesting morning. Why don't you start by just giving us a little centering? Because we should tell our listeners he is actually here in our studio. Yeah. In person and duly noted 6 feet away. But we are so excited when we get live bodies in the studio. It just makes it for so much more fun. Yeah. So how is it that we got you in the studio live? You must live pretty close.
Well, yeah, I just moved out to Driftwood area probably 2 months ago. And it's right around the corner. And I've been a big fan of Rodney's work for years. I'm surprised we actually haven't met face to face.
Well, we've met once.
Uh-oh.
It was
were we drinking?
It could have been.
Yeah.
No, actually, you know what it was? It was when Annie Leibovitz
was at
the Long Center.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was out waiting on some friends of mine.
I do remember that. I met you on the stairs.
Well, that's a name dropper for two photographers.
Yeah, we're hanging out with Annie. And
did she know that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I remember that now because we were on the stairs just outside. Mm-hmm. That's right.
But yeah, Chick was asking me how I knew you, and I'm sure it's just the cert running in circles. And do you know Pat O'Brien?
Pat O'Brien's from my hometown.
I think he's the one that told me years ago, is like, you need to meet Greg Davis. And of course, you know, whenever the conversations are coming up, your name comes up so many times.
Oh, cool.
It's like, well, you're in Austin, you know Greg Davis.
You know, so, I had my first kiss in his father's establishment there in Livingston.
The movie theater?
The Fame Theater, yeah. Yep, exactly.
So. I'm jotting that down because I fully intend to come back to it later. You know, Livingston kiss. All right.
I think it was Pat and he had told me your story. And
well, here's all Rodney told me about you. Because Rodney does know so many, to say cool is just so reductionist, but really cool, but interesting people that are just doing the most wonderful things, both with their art and their lives. And he says, yeah, I got this friend, and he quit his corporate job, and he sold everything, and then he went around the world doing photography. I'm like, okay, I could unpack that sentence in a podcast, just that one sentence for an hour. So, but why don't we start with your description of yourself and how you got to this place where you're doing these fabulous things that you're doing?
It's a pretty wild story. I go back to the beginning in high school. As a matter of fact, Rodney, I think you're from Conroe, right? Mm-hmm. So
I don't tell many people that.
You're from Conroe? I've known you all this time. Oh my gosh. Thanks, Greg, for that little tidbit.
And I'm from Livingston, just around the corner. Yep. And I bet I got tons of friends. I was always drawn to Conroe dudes. I mean, I could probably name drop, and you probably know half of them. Mm. Kaysinger.
Mm-hmm.
Wes Johnson, Colby Thames.
Yep. Just sure to hashtag all these people.
Yeah. Yeah, so just tons of these guys, and always been drawn to these guys. I knew we'd get along when we met and had time to sit down. But Livingston High School, my dad had a Canon AE-1 camera, and I grabbed it and thought this is a great way to meet the posing cheerleading girls was really my thought. Was I can go over there and take pictures while during the football game. And
see,
hey,
that would have been me.
Yeah, I thought this is a great idea. So I started taking photos and showed a little bit of talent at it, and what ended up being the high school newspaper photographer dark room. I love the fact that I get to go into a dark room for a whole hour of high school, mm-hmm. and had an assistant
with pretty, the cheerleaders,
a pretty girl. Yeah, actually I did. I had the prettiest girl in journalism class. So did that, and you know, Dad says, "Hey, son, you're about to graduate from high school. What do you want to do with your life? And I'm like,
I want to rock.
I said, you know, I don't know. I'm art school. And he's like, no. What do you want to do?
We're on very similar paths.
Yeah. And I was like, what do you want me to do? And he said, I want you to go to Baylor and get your business degree, and then you can do whatever you want to do. So I was a fourth generation. My great-grandmother actually went to Baylor in the late 1800s, so I bleed green and gold. And wow, good for her. What a lady to have been able to go to college in the late 1800s. So yeah, he sent me off to Baylor. I got my business degree, and long story short, I woke up 16 years later or so at this desk job working in high tech.
Still on the same path.
Yeah. And then here's the diversion of this, and I'll keep it short. So there's a 4-year span in there that I had 6 family members passed. I was attacked by a gang. I've got 40 stitches in my head and neck from a violent attack. Yeah. I lost, I won't go into the figure, but lost a lot, 90% of my money in a bad financial move. I was cheated on by the love of my life at that moment. And I flipped my car 3 times after being drunk and literally climbed out of the top of the car that was sideways, and it flipped 3 times and made it without a scratch. So here I was, broke, brokenhearted, beaten, battered from the gang attack, and everybody around me was dying. My dad, my grandmother, my aunt, my uncle, and my cousin, 3 cousins, ultimately 3 cousins. But there was a 4-year span in there. And then throw in 9/11, which I think was a heartbreak for a lot of people too. So I turned to alcohol. I was drinking a lot. And, one night I just had enough, and I just surrendered to something greater and said, you gotta engage here because I'm not in a good place, and please show me the path and I'll forever speak of it, you know? And the sort of proverbial lightning struck and the God winks, the serendipity, the synchronicity happened in my life, and I'd asked, so I was looking for it, and I embraced it, and it was clear I was supposed to sell it all, quit the job, and take off. And I grabbed a $400 point and shoot camera. I went around the world from 04 to 05, and when I got back, someone discovered these images I set up on a street corner on West 6th Street, selling my work out of a chicken coop, basically, the small little art festival, and from the very first day, it was clear this was the new path.
So that voice or that prompting, that sense of inspiration or fate, you use interesting words, I've noticed. Was it specifically around go take your camera and go photograph the world? It was just you got to change your life or do something? Or?
Yeah, there was something in there that said to re-engage with the world. I'd pretty much pulled away from it with everything, and the camera was the passport to re-engage with people. I'd lost trust for people. I was attacked by them. I'd lost trust for the system it had stolen from me. I lost trust of God. He had taken my family from me. I'd lost trust and people also because my girlfriend had cheated on me. So there was a lot of different things I'd lost trust for. And so this was my access to be able to reach out to other people. And these intimate portraits came out of it.
So where did you go first?
This was 04. So post 9/11, and we decided to go, and I went with 2 other people. We decided to go to, it was a couple, and we ended up departing, kind of separating about 4 months in, but in the beginning we were together and started in Turkey, and then went through South Africa, covered about 4 countries in Southern Africa, and then into India, Nepal, Southeast Asia, Australia, and back home. So about a year journey, and it changed everything.
Because about 9 months into that, something pretty dramatic happened.
Yeah, I was on a trail, just a fateful moment. I was on a trail in Vietnam, in the mountains of Vietnam, in outside an area called Sapa, which is on the Chinese border, and there's a lot of ethnic minority tribes that live in the area, and there's the Black Hmong and the Striped Hmong, Red Hmong, and they still use these very traditional, farming techniques and very traditional weaving and dyeing techniques, and there was a trail coming up. I was in the mountains by myself, and there was a trail coming up from the valley, and I was coming down the trail from up above, and these trails converged, and literally our lives converged at that moment. She was a little bit ahead of me, probably, I don't know, maybe 50 to 50 to 100 feet up in front of me walking, so she didn't see me. Long flowing, you know, indigo dress, pillbox hat, embroidered metal earrings that they wear, and her hands were flashing blue and green. And so I was like, wow, that's interesting. And I'd been on the road at that point for 9 months, so, you know, I was seeing things, was drawn to all these different ways of being. And so, and I was, at that point, I had my confidence to approach a stranger pretty easily. So I approached her and tapped her on the shoulder, and she turned around and she saw this and kind of freaked out. She's like, whoa, what's this guy doing here? And here we were alone, and I kind of frightened her a little bit. So I had to kind of stoop a little bit and, you know, kind of make myself a little smaller and, you know, not as broad. You know, you want to kind of shrink a little bit just to, you know, put my hands together in prayer and kind of everything's fine. But I asked her with sign, you know, what was on her hands. And she had her, I could see her sort of thinking it over, like, what, how can I explain this to this guy? What I do? Like, and she tapped one hand, she tapped the other hand, and she kind of acted like she was putting them in like a bucket or, you know, the two hands. And then she started making this like weaving motion. And I was just called to like ask her to put them together because one was blue and one was green. I thought, I've never seen a woman with two colored hands. So she did that. I took one shot with this little $400 camera, this Olympus camera, and she looked at me like I was crazy and walked along, and that was it. And I looked at the camera on the back and didn't think a whole lot about it at the time. And then 3 months later, I got back into the States, and then, you know, that's when someone said, hey, I want to come see your work at this little market, and this thing kind of surfaced. And that's a whole nother story about how it even came about. But yeah, it, who knew that moment? And that moment really has been sort of, that's my signature piece, and it really speaks to so many people in so many different ways.
Yeah, I've seen that piece, and I knew nothing about it. So yeah, to hear that, that's really cool. And it's, I, the thing that's amazing for me is that when I go on these kind of trips, I mean, that, you know, at least now, you know, photography, that's why I'm there. And you, it wasn't even your MO. You were just out and about, and you come back with these amazing photos, and from a point and shoot camera. So, you know, people are always calling, say, well, you know, I need to get a camera, what should I get? It's like,
you already got it,
whatever you can afford, you know.
Yeah, you already got it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, and they're gifts, you know, they really are. And you know that in your line of work too. It's, you can prepare and plan, but there's all these magic little gifts that happen in the work that sort of just show up. And if we're present and we're aware of it, then we'll be able to share that with other people. And my work's very documentary style. Like, I don't do a lot of planning. I do have some ideas going in sometimes, and I'll create some work. But for the most part, it's magic moment. Yeah. And I love that about it. It's just continually connects me to something greater when I see that it's been provided for me to share with other people. So it's pretty cool.
You mentioned just a second ago, kind of parenthetically, that there was, well, that was a story too about how you got to the market that day and how that got set up. Tell us about that. Because okay, this is an example where I'm just so aware of how you, that you are aware of there are these pivotal moments. You've used the word magic, you've used the word fate, and those are the things I'm just fascinated in around what creates art and how life and the spirit of our life happens. So those are the things I'm going to keep coming back and digging into. So what was that moment? What was that story?
So, you know, I got back from this trip. I had this $400 camera. I had a little bit of call it a blog, a little website, and I would write stories and I would post my photos. And this was 04, 05, so we're talking pre-social media. Sort of people kind of had little websites, you know, kind of thing. And it was really for my family and friends to follow along. And I thought, you know, there might be a chance that I might be able to sell a few pictures and, you know, buy myself lunch today here and there. You know, it really was the thought. So I didn't go into this thing completely blind. But by the time I got home, I think I'd sold $200 the whole year I was gone. So I thought, well, okay, well, that didn't work. Yeah. You know, what am I going to do now? So I got back, and I knew I didn't want to go back to corporate America. I was 36 at the time when I got back. And I called three friends of mine, who are brothers who own a lot of bars in Austin. And they had a bar called the Velvet Spade, which was a new bar for them down on Red River. It's where the Mohawk is now. And they said, yeah, we got this new bar, because I'd never bartended. They're like, we'll put you down at Velvet Spade and, you know, you'll be great down there. So I was at the bar, meeting a lot of the clientele. You know, at some point, one of the brothers, one of the owners said, you know, I know you just got back from this trip and you've been talking about these photos. Would you be interested in hanging them up in the bar? And I thought, well, sure, you know, why not? So I went down to, I'm embarrassed to say, because I had no clue about fine art or anything, you know, Hobby Lobby or Walmart or wherever I went, you know. Well,
yeah, when I first started, I was buying my picture frames at Target.
There you go. Yeah.
What? You're not supposed to do that?
Yeah, exactly.
No.
Yeah, you know, just not knowing, and it's fine now, but I would love to take those. I'd love to find those originals and replace them with quality archival work now, you know.
Yeah.
But I printed them up. I think I used Holland Photo here in Austin in the beginning and had probably 8 images that I thought I just kind of went out to my own little blog site and grabbed a few and thought that the ones that told the best stories and some that I'd actually written stories about and put the little story next to them and put them on the wall. And somebody stole the one that was close to the door. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wait a second.
That's a compliment, I guess.
I may have something here, you know? This might work out. And then the girl that I'd met on my trip while I was in Australia, when I was traveling, and I was in Australia 11 months in, met her, and she was from Toronto, and she flew into Austin to visit, and, I'd had this work in this bar, you know, my first time to ever kind of show my photography, and she said, wow, you really should consider, you know, doing something. Is there like an art scene here in Austin? You know? I have no idea. Like, I came from the corporate world. I've never really been an artist. And at 04-05, you know, Austin's a different place. And we happened to be meeting a friend of mine at, can't recall the name of the place right now, Mother Egan's Pub on West 6th Street across from Jay Black's. There's a little open parking lot right there. And that was an art market. And as we're meeting my friend at Mother Egan's next door, we walk by and Christine says to me, she goes, why don't you walk in that little market right there while those people are selling the art and see what that's all about. And so I stumbled in reluctantly almost, and who runs this place? And I can get that guy back there with the goatee. And I said, hi, I'm Greg. I think I'm a photographer.
You decide.
Yeah. She thinks I'm great. I'm dating her. So
full transparency.
Yeah. And he said, yeah, well, sure, we'll set you up. We'll give you a little booth and give you some walls and just go print up your work and come on back next weekend. It's $25. And I was like, what? $25? I think I can
handle it. I only made 200.
I think I can handle this. I can get my head around 25. I thought, why not? So we did our thing that week and went and got some things matted and printed. And I got a picture of my first day. It's so fun to look at because it's like, wow, how humble. It's really amazing to look back at that moment because it really changed everything at that moment, because I set up and people just responded. The people that came to that market were just like, wow, what?
Did they want to hear the stories as well?
They did. Yeah. They did. They were so interested because I think the photos were speaking, and I'd never knew that they could speak like that, because when they're on this blog, you know, and sure, your parents say, or your mom says she loves them, and the girlfriend says she loves them, but to have a total stranger, really see something in it that you were unaware of, it's really magic.
Yeah. No, it's that's what I've been so intrigued about you, because so many people, I think, are drawn not only, you know, to the beauty of your photography, but the stories and your story behind it. And people, so many people, I think, are living their life vicariously through you, because who doesn't want to quit their corporate job and just go travel the world? But everybody's afraid to do it, and you did it. And
there's a cost.
Yeah.
You know, there's a cost.
But it's a
small cost for the freedom, the adventure, the things I've seen are just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's worth it.
And the trust that I've regained by allowing myself to be vulnerable enough to not know. You know, you go to a job, you get the paycheck, you know, you can plan, you can prepare. And with art, I've made 95% of my income is through selling art. And the trust that I've gained from the something else is taking care of this for me too. It's not
what
just me.
What would you describe as the cost for you?
Sometimes the unknown is hard to embrace. Not knowing where it's going to come from, not know when it's going to come. Sort of, I mean, as a Taurus, I'm grounded and I want stability and I want, you know, and I don't get that with this because it comes in waves. But when it comes, it's like, wow, just last night, for example, something amazing has happened. So I can't talk about it quite yet, but.
Oh, come on. We won't tell anybody.
next podcast.
Yeah.
It's in the talks.
But it's a great opportunity for me that you sort of just fluttered in. You know, I had to give up the American sort of like, I'm going to have the big house and the, you know, this idea that I was raised with, which is, you know, these are the things that you do. You get a job, you have a child, you get a house, you get the, so being able to sort of let go of all of that, you know, so there is some suffering in that a little bit, just having to finally ultimately get to a point where it's okay, Greg, that's not your path, and it's okay. But there is some challenge in all of that to try to get to the point, to the other side of it, and go and breathe and go, you know what? I'm there. I'm good. It's okay. So those are some of the things, you know.
Like you're saying, the normal everyday things that we're supposed to be doing, that society tells us we're supposed to, because I've done that. And I...
Like have a dog, Rodney. Yeah. You don't even have a dog, Rodney. Yeah.
But I live in a 900 square foot house, and you know, that's the thing with, you know, social media. You look at these photos and your friends, and there you see the photos with their families and these big homes, and it's like, here I am in my little cabin, and there's those moments you're going, I didn't get that. Why didn't I do that?
And your little cabin in the beautiful Texas hill country, looking at one of the most spectacular oak trees that ever lived.
Those are the moments when those friends come over and then they're going, oh my God, I can't believe you're doing this. So it's, you know, it's always the grass is always greener.
You played this well. You got a great spot here. And I've got this place in Driftwood now, so things are fine, you know. But there is a moment that you have to deal with that. Yeah. You have to be willing to just roll the dice.
Yeah, am I doing the right thing? I've finally accepted it, and I'm glad I'm on the path that I am.
So yeah. Well, was there ever a time, and this is a question for both of you, Rodney, if you don't mind me drawing you into this. Tell me about some of the times when, in the dark of night, and you're on your third bourbon, maybe you're thinking, man, I did screw up. I'm not sure this is going to work out.
It's happened for sure. I think throughout, because it gets slim, and especially with this coronavirus situation, I make my living on selling work and the way for people to see it. Yes, you can see it digitally, but when you see the object, you know, when you're able to witness the object itself, there's something different about a piece that's there on paper or canvas. In some cases, I don't do a lot of canvas, but when it's on paper and it's framed nicely and it's a thing and you can grab that thing and take it with you, and there's something about having that object that's a lot different. And because of this, I haven't been able to show those objects as much, so it's been a little bit challenging. I'm not questioning where I'm at. If it were earlier on in my career, I might, but I think I'm beyond the hump.
Yeah, you trust that process and how it's going to ebb and flow.
Yeah. You get used to that. And, you know, my mother told me something early on. She goes, honey, when things got a little tight, you know, she goes, well, you're just going to have to eat your corn real close to the cob.
East Texas.
Yep, coming at you.
Right. Oh, I love that. How about you, Rodney? Every time you thought, oh, man, maybe I shouldn't have done this.
I don't know that I've got any regrets. You know, I've definitely had some fears of, you know, but I don't think I've got any regrets for the past that I've chosen. You know, I'm happy.
The three of us sitting around here, and in my own way, I've made some very oddball choices about how to live as an adult woman in this world. In fact, my mother at one point said to me regarding something, well, honey, if you're going to flaunt convention, you need to expect these things. But they're also the people I am so attracted to, the ones that have the stories, the ones that lead from the heart and are authentic. And when I know people like you and a lot of people that we know, Rodney, I don't feel so weird. I feel like I'm at home, and then I have to leave the tribe and go someplace else, and it feels a little weird. But there is that sense of, you know, your family, the people that, that get you, and there might be very different paths. I mean, look at the two of you. And,
what's
and
those of us who have chosen our lives, you know, I feel like when I was in corporate America, it was being chosen for me personally. Not speaking of anyone else, but for me personally, it was being handed to me. You know, I wasn't using my gifts. Didn't know my gifts. So thankfully, when I asked, they showed up, you know. And then it's taken, you know, a lot of people ask, when they see my work and it's big and grand and I'm at an exhibit and I'm, you know, doing my thing. And how did you get to this place? Like, what?
You just did it.
It's called grit. Yeah. It's called faith. Devotion and purpose. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I've been at it now for about 15 years. Mm.
Well, I'd like us to turn on another, sounds like a pivotal moment of fate.
We're going to play one of his songs?
Do we have a song? Do we have a song of yours?
Working on it.
Oh, okay. Because we love to do that when we've got them. I miss that completely. That I read something and I wrote it down because I'm catching these themes about these moments where you just, you are in a moment, you are following your path, and these moments appear, and then you move into them. And this said, in 2013, the Midland, Texas-based Museum of the Southwest commissioned you to shoot a theme based on myth and legend, and you chose to follow a religious pilgrimage in India. Now, putting those two things together, that would not have necessarily been my first pivot when the Museum of the Southwest would want me to do something about myth and legend. How did that convergence come together to follow that path and then tell us what happened because of it?
Yeah, the previous year, Midland Museum of the Southwest has an outdoor art festival that I had won Best in Show at the year before, and they approached me and said we would be honored if you would consider doing an indoor exhibition. And we're going to do 6 artists for the year, 2 months for each exhibit, varying, you know, mediums, sculpture and painting and photography. And we're going to give all of the artists Myth and Legend is the title. And you can use existing work or you can create your own exhibit, whatever you want. And in my line of work, in Rodney's line of work, you know, and once you're in it, you sort of start knowing about all these things. And the world's largest pilgrimage, which is mythical and legendary, so it fit for me in that mold of myth and legend, was the Kumbh Mela, which is every 12 years. Technically, it's every 4, but every 12, it returns to this one grand place. It's the big Maha Kumbh Mela. And it's where 3 rivers come together in India, the Ganges, the Yamuna, and then they believe there's a mythical river called the Saraswati River. So at the confluence of those 3 rivers, the Hindus believe that a Hindu believes in reincarnation. But a Hindu can be reincarnated or can break that cycle of reincarnation when they're either buried, when they die, when they're buried into the Ganges, or in life, they can make this pilgrimage, this Kumbh Mela pilgrimage, and drink and bathe in those waters at that confluence. And when they do that, it breaks the cycle of reincarnation, and they no longer come back to this earthly plane. They go on to the next phase. So it was attended in 2013. They estimated that 120 million people came to Kumbh Mela.
Wow.
The Hajj in the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, I don't know. I'm kind of guessing, but I think it's 4 or 5 million, something like this. And Kumbh Mela is 120 estimated. I've heard as low as 80, and I've heard as high as 120. But it's 55 days long. People from all over the world, all over India, you know, some fly in on their jets, not very few, and most walk or ride the trains or make their way via the bus systems to this place. And can you imagine what it would take to house or to sleep or to feed that many people? The biggest day was 30 million. On February the 1st, 2013, there were 30 million people. Basically, imagine everyone in Texas down on Town Lake, you know, and camping. It was unbelievable scene. Especially now, can you imagine? It's like he's giving me the heebies to think about it. But it was an amazing journey.
Maybe we should start that.
Yeah. You start it, Ryan.
Austin would love that.
Yeah, we'll call it the Brasil Gathering.
Yeah, it was incredible. Really incredible. So that project was, for me, an 18-day project. And I knew that I didn't want my very first museum exhibition to just be photography. I've always got to like kind of raise my own personal bars, my comfort zone, get myself in uncomfort zone, which was let's do a motion portion of it.
So that was, I remember you doing that. That was all tied in with this.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So I hired a young man, Travis Tank, very talented young man, to be my DP. And we went into it sort of.
A
director of photography is a cinematographer. And sort of an unknown plot. We had no idea. There was no story. The story was going to reveal itself through our journey. Mm-hmm. And it did. It took a lot of work, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Have you done film?
I wanted to kind of talk to you about that, but I've done a little bit. I've done a couple music videos, but not serious.
It's a monster. It's a lot going
on.
It's a
lot of work. And I just, did you do your editing or
I did not.
That's the part I can't, I cannot fathom. I love getting that one moment in time and living with that and just, bringing that photo out. But I can't, I don't know how video editors can take hours of clips and know where to put them together and make this piece of art. I can't wrap my brain
with sound, with voice, with movement, with transitions. It's really incredible. Hats off to those people that do it. And fortunately, I had a lot of people show up. And I say show up, they didn't come knocking on my door, but they showed up in my life, and I embraced the connection that was made at that moment. I was introduced through a common friend of mine to this this editing house, and the owner. I told her, I sat down, had a meeting with her and told her about it. And she just started getting this big smile on her face. I was like, what? She goes, I went to that museum as a child, grew up going to the Museum of the Southwest. I'll take your project from here. I'll help you edit it. Yeah. So just things like that. Another God wink, right?
So you just gave her 100,000 hours of footage and hey, here's where it might go. And she dove into all of that
We had to sort of provide a story for her. And so again, these God winks happened. And I met someone who,
there's the title of your book,
God winks. Yeah. Yeah. I did a lot of them. I wish I had a good memory or written them all down because they start to get sort of hazy as I get older. But, met a young lady who I literally locked myself in my studio with her for months, and she pulled out what this thing was because we had to go back to all the clips. I didn't really want to be in the film to begin with. So there's not very much of me, which is good. But when you're trying to tell this film the way we're trying to tell it, I needed to be in it the way that it worked. And the story came to be that there were three men. I mean, there's 120 million people who made that journey, but in this story, there was three. Because there's three rivers. There's the Ganges, Yamuna, and Saraswati rivers, and there's these three men that represent those three rivers, that represent these three things that are pillars in all of our lives that we can use to connect to something greater, which is why we're all here anyway. This sadhu, this holy man, a sadhu is someone who's given up everything. A sadhu had it and said, you know what, I don't need it. Gave it all away. And his life now, quote unquote, has no. He told me, my life has no tribulation. I had wealth. I gave it all away. I said, where do you live? He said, the sky is my roof. The land is my room. I was like, whoa, that's all amazing. to me, I'm living in my studio. I'm close, but I was living in my studio. And then Andre Eichmann, the second man, was there burying his father. He was an American man who flew in from, he was working in, I think, Singapore at that time. He's working in Hong Kong at that time. And he flew in to bury the rest of his father's remains, who had passed about 5 years ago, and he'd been spreading his dad's ashes all over the world. And he came walking into our camp of 30 square miles of possibilities. This man walks into our camp with a bag of ashes that his father had died. My father had died, you know, not too many years before. And here he was, you know, with this devotion to his dad. So we filmed, we asked him, and then he agreed the next day. At first he said no, and then he agreed the next day because I feel like this is really has the right intention, you know, you guys are coming at it. So he allowed us to go out and actually watch him bury his father. And then there was a little bit of content with me, and then so I'm in there as the third river. The pillars are faith, devotion, and purpose. We're all, each here to connect to something greater than ourselves. With faith, devotion, and purpose in our lives, we have a chance of doing that. So Mohan represents the Saraswati. The Saraswati is the river that you can't see. It's underneath the two rivers. So it's sort of the river of faith. So Mohan represents faith. Andre, who's bearing his father, represents the river, Ganges River, because it's the river of devotion. It's the God in their belief, in the Hindu belief. And so Andre represents that river of devotion. And then with purpose, you have to sort of have clarity in what you're doing. And the Yamuna River is a much more clear river than the Ganges River. So there's clarity in that water, and there's clarity in purpose.
Even with 120 million people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Ganges is really filthy. There are people working on it, but it's a big mission to get those things cleaned. Hopefully they can, because it's a beautiful space. But 120 is a lot of, 120 million is a lot of folks to find a place to do the business, you know what I mean? But bigger than that is the reason that they come, you know?
Where can you find the video? Is it just out online now, or people to see it? Or
so I was contacted by Gaia, G-A-I-A, Gaia.com. It's sort of they say it's the Netflix of spirituality.
I remember them. I haven't seen, they haven't popped up in a while. But
yeah, they were marketing pretty hard for a long time. Yeah. I saw that. They picked it up. I think they saw it maybe at South by Southwest, or I can't recall how they came about. But we did the film festival circuit with the film, and they picked it up in Arizona. There was a film festival in what's the spiritual place in
Sedona?
Sedona, yeah, it was at the Sedona Film Festival.
I saw a picture of the poster of the film, and you can barely see the poster because there's like 18 of all of these film festival awards and the best of this and that from all over. It was pretty stunning.
Well, we appreciate it. You know, I was learning to ride a bicycle and this whole thing, you know, just figuring it out. And
this is your first film.
First film. Mm-hmm. And again, good
with a cast of 120 million.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. the largest cast in history.
I tried to get them all in.
Mm-hmm. The credits just roll for days.
Oh, man, they're still going on.
Yeah, we're pleased, and hats off to everybody that helped with it. And those who came to see it, and those who have appreciated it. It's 11 minutes short, so, you know, don't get any popcorn or anything. Yeah. It's over before you...
Or a small bag. Right?
Yeah.
Don't get the bucket.
It's a beautiful little piece. Super proud. And you can stream... You can go to Gaia if you have a subscription. Or you can go... You can Google Cloth Paper Dreams, and it lives out online.
I say the name of the film again?
Oh, sorry. Cloth?
Cloth Paper Dreams. Okay. I want to be sure everybody hears that.
What's the story
paper
of that?
Dreams.
So Mohan, who is the sadhu, we just were asking him a myriad of questions about his life, and at one point he was talking about the Kumbh Mela, the festival itself, and he said, Cloth Paper Dreams, the city is made of these things, and the city he speaks of is this temporary city. I mean, so there's a city called Allahabad that's sort of right there at the confluence. But the city itself that he spoke of was this temporary city. I mean, they bring in all of the electrical that they bring in for the event, all of the bathrooms that they bring in, all of the food. I mean, you can only imagine they prepare months and years in advance to be able to support this sort of, you know, number of people. So Cloth Paper Dreams, the city is made of these things. So cloth, all of the temples, and there's rows and rows and avenues of temples. And where this thing is located, so they have the Kumbh Mela in February when all of the ice is locked up in the Himalayas. So the Ganges River is smaller, you know, once March, once May gets there and the snow starts melting off, then the river raises and the banks of the river, you know, the river's a mile wide.
Really?
But in February, because of the ice is all locked up in the Himalayas, there's a lot of, you know, it's a smaller river, but you still have all of that sort of river bottom. Mm-hmm. And that's where they have this thing. And these avenues are set up on a grid system, and all of these temples come in, and they're all bamboo with cloth. They're cloth wrapped so that they're easy to set up and break down. They're all temporary structures, so cloth represents the cloth that the temples are made of. It represents the saris. It represents the turbans. Paper represents the paper boats that people say their prayers, the money that's transacted, and dreams are the hopes and dreams and prayers and
that they're getting out of here.
That they're getting out of here alive.
Exactly.
They get to go to the next step, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Cloth Paper Dreams, the city is made of these things, was that was our title at that point. Was, you know, that's what this whole thing is anyway. Even us here now, it's all temporary.
So I'm wondering, you know, out of the corporate world, you probably had your own experiences with five-year plans and, you know, one-year development plans and things like that. And that's clearly not your life. And then these incredible currents of events and possibilities coalesce into a moment which call you and you recognize and these things happen. So you start this year trip, you're going on this Myths and Legends, and you end up making this film. And the film is shown, and it's well-received, and you're winning awards. As you sit back from that now, what are some takeaways from that? What are some of your resonant thoughts about that period and perhaps where it may have led you today?
That's a great question, because it did sort of push me in a certain direction, and that direction came to be that the Museum of the Southwest was the first place to show the work, which was the 24 photographs, the 11-minute short film. And to open up, I had partnered with a sitar player, Indrajit Banerjee, who plays sitar for Atash, which is an award-winning Austin world band, and Gauri Sankar Karmakar, who's the tabla player, the drum player. So I brought those guys in to play traditional Indian music for the opening. And then I partnered with Anu Nampali, who owns and runs the Austin Dance India, and her daughter came out to do an interpretive dance about this pilgrimage and the cleansing that happens at the riverfront. So it was amazing. They came out in traditional Indian wear, and they were holding this long blue piece of fabric, kind of clear, and they kind of danced further and further apart from each other. They were probably about 20 feet apart from each other, and one of them takes that blue material and sort of whips it, and it creates this wave that runs all the way across to the other person. So all of a sudden, I could see the audience sort of like, oh, wow, okay, that's water. They set it down, then they started washing themselves at the waterfront. So amazing interpretation of what this thing was. So what I found was really cool was that this art connected the Indian community to the arts, had a conversation that was happening with the Indian communities in Midland and the art community in Midland. And so my focus, and even before that moment, but my focus was I want to have this thing go around to Texas cities, mid-cities. I think that mid-cities needed it more than the big cities. But I ended up showing it in, I think, 8 Texas cities, Abilene, Lubbock, Waco. Showed in Austin at the Blanton one night. Can't recall right now. Georgetown, Art Center. Georgetown, it was a rainy night. You know, we did all this work to get set up for it. Oh, and we had Indian food at these things a lot. Oh, and so a local, you know, person would, a restaurant would come in and give a taste of India. So you really had sort of a, all of the senses, and then you had this thing happening that the local Indian community were coming out and they were dressing up. They were on their little pilgrimages to come to this little event, and it turned out to be big events. It turned out to be really cool to see that happen, and you know, with the music and the food, and I just thought, you know what, this is a great thing. This is a great place for me to be this cultural sort of an artist that brings the world to Texans through the arts, and lets people engage in things that they've never experienced. So I'm currently working on for the last couple of years, is a Oaxacan project. So Waco.
Yeah, you've been going down there a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great place.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what you create with that. Yeah, I'd love it down there. So
have you been down there?
I haven't been in a while, but
you surf, right?
I try. I do more of the photography, so I'm more comfortable without a surfboard out in the waves.
There's good surf in Oaxaca, Escondido, and that's cool. Yeah, I've been down there probably four times. Waco, which is one of the places that I showed my work, and I also went to Baylor and fourth generation. I showed the India work there in 2015, and my dad passed. He was one of the family members that died, but he had gone to Baylor and was a huge fan of the university and of the sports. And there I was at the new stadium in the VIP area. The Waco Art Center had partnered with Baylor to do this exhibition of this India work at the brand new stadium in the VIP area. And here I was, oh my God, it gives me chills to think about, like my dad looking down on that moment. Like it was really a powerful moment for me. And my, how things have changed. Here's Greg Davis, troublemaker with a Hindu pilgrimage at a Baptist university, right? Like, whoa, man, things are changed. But it went really well, so well that they reached out to me about 3 years ago, maybe, and said we're going to open up. So Waco's really killing it now with the Gaines family and the Magnolia. They're getting like 30,000 people. 30,000 people are going to Waco, Texas on the weekends, well, before COVID hit. So the art center said, you know what, we really need to capitalize on this. And their location has always been out by MCC, out by the lake. And so they bought property right down the street from the Gaines compound. They reached out to me and said, hey, we're going to build this new art center museum, and we really want you to be considered, because there's two people they're considering, one, me and a painter. But they said, we'd like for you to be considered as one of our inaugural exhibit for the brand new opening. And wow, what an honor again, you know, that they kind of bestowed on me. I said, what do you want? And they said, you're the artist, you know. Yeah. Well, here I am again, you know, like, okay, Oaxaca, Waco, it's got a nice ring, you know. But I thought also, you know, with the whole conversation, you know, building the wall and keeping them out, and let's just bring them over and have a celebration, you know. Let's just respect our neighbor and love your neighbor. And so I've been shooting down in Oaxaca. It's extremely culturally rich. And so I felt like I was, you know, getting in my zone with it. And then COVID has hit, and we'll figure out a way to finish it off. I've got some other things I want to tell. Ultimately, I'd like a 20-piece exhibit. I don't think there will be a film involved, but I have partnered with the Mexican consulate is aware. They're on board to help. I've also been speaking with, and they're on board, Oaxaca Arte e Movimiento, which is a dance troupe here in Austin. So they'll bring the costumes, the traditional dance. I've also talked to a weaver. They do traditional weaving in Oaxaca. They still use the indigo, which goes back to the blanket weaver. Mm-hmm. The blue and the green hands was indigo. So here we are with indigo. But he was going to bring his, or he's going to bring his big weaving machine and, you know, the traditional indigos. They also still dye their yarns with the cochineal. And the cochineal is an insect that grows on a certain type of cactus down there, and they've been using this, you know, way back in the day. But when you squish this bug, it's red, and that's how they're getting their red dye. So still traditional, really cool. And then of course, mezcal. We got to get they got to get the Baptist dancing.
We'll be there. You know?
So it's all sort of all these pieces again are coming together, you know. Right. But that's ultimately, I think, you know, a Texan bringing culture to other Texans through the arts. You know, I feel like that's sort of where I'm positioning this whole sort of next chapter, if you will.
The power of photography.
Yeah.
Yes.
And storytelling and sharing and the power of the other, like the interest in what these people do. And I just, it's so fascinating when you go down and you learn sort of the culture of Oaxaca. I mean, even like there's a group of African Mexicans, not African Americans, African Mexicans. Mm-hmm. So there was a Spanish merchant who brought some slaves over and on the west coast of Oaxaca started growing, you know, all sorts of things, cotton and everything he could sell. And he ended up going back to Spain and it was either shipwrecked or pirated or something happened. And that group of people was deserted in this area. And so they're still there today. And it's just really fascinating to go visit them. And they're still playing some of the traditional African instruments. And but who knew? Mm-hmm. I mean, I had no idea. Right. I had no idea. Yeah. So I learn something every time I go down. Yeah. Really fascinating. So I hope to bring back, the mushroom was a big thing in Oaxaca. Maria Sabina and Wasson, who was the gentleman who went down in 57 and did the magic mushroom and came back and told the story in Life magazine. And then Leary happened at the same time. And then boom, you know, the 60s happened. So that needs to be a part of the exhibit too, at least some part of that story. You know, she's passed, Maria Sabina's passed, and it could be a relative, but I'm not sure I want it to be a portrait of a relative. It might be some story of the mushroom that's in the photographic work, so I can tell that part of the story of Oaxaca, because I think it's important. So still work to do. We'll see once this thing sort of blows over.
Yeah, when this is all done, is that where you're heading back?
That's the target. That's the target for the next year.
With our guests that we're talking to, like, what's the first place you're going to go with that passport as soon as a checkered flag goes down?
Yeah,
and
passports,
Rodney's got
please.
His places and you've got yours. I just have a very prurient question to ask. Have you had much contact with any of your colleagues back in the corporate world?
Yeah, actually, you know, I've...
Have you been a real high-level speaker there and said, hey, here's what you can do with your life?
I don't think they want me in there.
I don't think so either.
I don't think they want me in there
but
at all.
I am curious about those that have kept up with you, what some of that influence may be, your influence.
You know, the first story that pops in my head is there's a coworker that I was working really tightly with named Kelly Whaley, and we were going out for this job to be promoted to an outside sales position at Hewlett-Packard. And we were the last two in the final interviews, and we drove up to Denver, and we were sitting outside the offices, and we kind of looked at each other, and, you know, congratulations on getting here. It's me and you, you know? And we agreed, like, you know, hey, if I don't get this and you get it, I'm out. I'm taking off. And she goes, same thing. If I don't get it, and I'm leaving. I'm going. And she said, I think I won the deal.
I think I got the job.
Yeah. Wow. So, and Kelly still keeps in touch. And, last couple weekends, I've had my studio. I've got a gallery studio in South Austin. And I've got the garage door open. And it's called Gusto. And it's just about a mile south of downtown. And, you know, of course, safety protocols. You know, limited capacity at the same time, and then, you know, hand washing and social distancing, the whole thing to keep people safe. And we've had people come by, and I had someone that I hadn't seen in years that I worked with probably in 97, I think. And he came by and supported me and just was, you know, I was just so proud that I was...
You're carrying the banner for
doing it. Yeah,
people.
I was doing it. He's got two kids in the house in Round Rock, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
as soon as these kids are out of the house, I'm going to do this too.
Oh, then you're supporting the grandkids.
Yeah. Yeah, I just decided to take a different path, and it was offered to me, and I needed it. I needed this to happen. I needed to be able to share. I didn't realize how I saw the world impacted others like it does.
Yeah, it's been fun. Like, I've thought about that with my underwater photography. And, you know, if you're not a diver, you don't know what's down there. You're not seeing it. And what I've brought, telling stories about nature and wildlife. And I've actually had people email me that are like, yeah, I'm never eating fish again. Or, you know, it's they once they see it, they get it. And it's like when I, you know, go down to the Bahamas and we go shark diving, and there's our one dive boat going out, and then there's 50 fishing boats going out. And I just want to go, come with us.
Yeah, right.
You know, come swim with them. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. why do you have to catch them? You know, I just, you know, shark fishing just grates me. You know, they all want that photo.
Right, and right. It's a like, trophy.
Yep. Yeah, come, I'll get your photo, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of similar to my situation when I went down to South Texas, you know. Mm-hmm. Same idea. I just can't do it. I'd rather view the beauty. But I get it. I understand. In some regards, I understand. You know,
Since I was a little girl, my mother accused me of something called nose trouble, which I guess I want to know everything, see everything, listen to everything, usually the inappropriate things. So that often leads to some of the questions that I like to ask. Before we officially got started, you were talking about a girlfriend, a partner, somebody special in your life. It's got to take an incredibly special person to not only get you, but to be aligned together. So do you mind talking a little bit about that and how that works? Because like you say, you're off traveling and
I'm a tough nut to crack anyway. Yeah. And throw on,
she must really be something
special.
She's
a special person, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I had an amazing quarantine response that was, again, a gift to me. I had met Amy a couple years before at a coffee shop randomly with a friend of ours that's a golfer.
Can we do random in air quotes?
We can do random, yeah. Yeah, because he's definitely not random at all. It was divine, to be honest. It was sort of meant to be. Jay's a real estate, owns a lot of Airbnbs, and he also is a professional golfer. He's got a kind of cool gig, too. She was staying at an Airbnb. She's from Fort Worth. She came into town, into Austin, to do a yoga retreat. She's a healer and does natural, you know, plant medicine and reflexology. She's a really deeply caring person. But we didn't know each other. We met, and she wasn't in a place, I wasn't in a place to do anything at that moment. And then a couple of years later, and she was coming back to Austin for another yoga retreat and reached out to me. And we went on two dates, and then COVID hit. And she's in Fort Worth. I'm in Austin. And we really enjoyed our time together, and we're literally on the phone for 4 hours a night. Like, I don't talk to anybody 4 hours a night, you know, but here I am, and we were just loving the conversation. It's quarantine. I got this person that we really are just digging on each other. A month later, in April, she's like, look, just come up to Fort Worth and give it to me. I don't care. I said, okay, well, I'm not saying no. That's always my thing. I'm not saying no, but I always have to think about things. So I'm not saying no, but I kind of ghosted her for about 3 days because I was prepping my departure from Austin to drive across the state of Texas in April, which, as we all know, we don't even know if you got it. We don't know what's going. It was just the fear was just setting in. It was a month into this thing. Is it reckless? You know, all this stuff's going through my head, but I was like, I got to go see this woman. So I packed up what I needed to, tied off my loose ends, grabbed some flowers and her favorite piece of art, drove to Fort Worth, got there about 8 p.m. at night, knocked on the door. She opens the door and was like, whoa, you know.
She didn't know you were coming.
She didn't know I was coming, yeah. She thought I'd ghost her. She was even talking to her friends like,
hey. I just want to bracket the words for all the women who are listening out there and the men. He grabbed flowers and her favorite piece of art. You had me at flowers and favorite piece of art. Go ahead.
And she, of course, was like, whoa. I said, well, taking you up on your offer here. And there we were for, you know, in quarantine together. And we got to really know each other. I mean, we've only been on two dates. And sure, we had talked on the phone, but here we are together. And we just kind of came up with this thing, morning confessions. We'd wake up in the morning and we'd be like, well, hey, I got something I want to confess to you, you know? And we kind of really kind of...
You jerk!
Don't ask if you don't want to know, please. But it was great. And then she's like, she pitched me this thing. She's like, you know, before we met, I was going to buy an RV, sell this house in Fort Worth, and take off in the RV for, you know, 4 months or so. Are you interested? I said, I'm not saying no. Let me think about it.
Let me ghost you for 3 more days.
Exactly. I'll be right next to you in bed. Yeah, and one day, you know, here a week later, I kind of roll over and said, I'm in. So we took off in the RV and socially distanced in, you know, southern Utah and Ouray, Telluride area. Took the two dogs with us, and up, you know, off we went. And did about 6,000 miles in the RV, and full circle back to Austin. Got a place out in Driftwood, and we're, it's not even a new chapter. It's like a new book.
Well, I'm certainly going to stay tuned. How about you, Rodney?
yeah, definitely.
Well, I remember seeing your work, Rodney. First time I saw it, it was the piece from of the whales in Solomon, maybe?
And well, it was either Socorro or Tonga.
Socorro, that's it. Not Solomon. Socorro. The separation between the mother and the baby. It's just like this perfect separation between the two.
That was the Socorro trip. That was the one where the orcas came in and
and separated the
baby. killed the baby. Oh, and wow. That was one of the most heart-wrenching moments of my life. Just to witness that, and you know, just and afterwards, because the orcas, like I said, you know, they did what they do, and we followed them out to sea for about an hour, and came back, and the mom was still there, because this particular island, it's called Roca Partida, and it's literally not much bigger than this studio. You can swim around it, and it's just out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in the middle of nowhere. And they had been hanging out there, and we came back, and the mom was just circling the island. And when, you know, I got in, and I'm just watching her do laps, and you can just see the anguish in her face, and you're just going, I just want to hug this animal, you know. And it was just, and we got back to Cabo. We left out of Cabo. We got back on Super Bowl night, and, you know, Cabo is just a big party. And imagine Super Bowl. And I didn't want to get off the boat. I didn't want to see humans. That changed my life. I think about it all the time.
Wow. That makes that photo even more special, really, to know that story. I remember seeing it in Wimberley at a gallery in the square.
Longleaf now, the restaurant. Yeah, it's okay. It used to be the gallery.
Okay.
And yeah, so now when it changed at the restaurant, it's still hanging up in there.
Whoever did this knows what they're doing. Yeah. That's what I thought when I saw that. Because I was still...
But you know what's funny is that was my first dive trip after being out of water for 20 years. And, you know, I grew up, my dad taught scuba, and we were just reef diving, Cayman Islands, you know, with reef fish. And I had never done anything like that. And that was my first trip back in the water after 20 years. And it's because I look at that photo and I go, God, I wish I knew what I was doing. Because I'm thinking, how much better could I have made? And that's the photographer brain.
Sure, the perfection thing. Yep.
But that was, in fact, that moment, the currents, I mean, you would drop 30 feet, you know, because you're like this. And I'm trying to get this photo and I'm fighting the currents. And all of a sudden I'd get slammed. I was like, what's behind me? I look back and I'm getting slammed into the island.
Wow.
Because it's just a rock drop off. And it was a tough shoot. And like I said, I didn't have a clue what I was doing.
Well, you nailed it. You even got recognized for it, right?
I'm not a writer, but sometimes the stories just write themselves.
I agree.
And that one just, it just came out. And people, you know, when they saw the story with it, you know, you can look at a great photograph, but, you know, just if you don't know this, when you know the story, it makes it an even better photograph.
I agree. I mean, I feel like that with my work for sure, too. It's just something now when people look, now when I look at that photo of yours, I mean, I'm going to think about that situation in life in general, and life's not fair. I mean, that's not fair for that mother or that child, that small well. But at the end of the day, we're on this thing together. And we know more of that now than we ever have. I mean, here we are, we're all in the same boat. That's what's so fascinating about these times. It's like we're all in this boat. We're all impacted by everybody else's decisions. And hopefully we can come out and be a little closer as a humanity and protecting our wildlife and a little more compassionate towards the other, you know, and the other isn't just another person, but it's our environment and animals.
Yeah.
And while we're in this boat, and can't get out to these fabulous exhibits and experiences that both of you are, you know, you're just so blessed to be able to engage in the world. Where can our listeners find your work? The static part of it on websites or
I have
the gallery. You mentioned the gallery in Austin. Mm-hmm. Give us some places that we can put on our website so folks can know how to go and learn more about you.
Yeah, well, my website is gregdavisphotography.com.
Oh, that's too easy.
I know it. Okay. And then my studio, which at this point will be open next weekend. I'm not sure when this will be edited, but December 19th and 20th will be open. And then it's by appointment only. There's on my website, there's also a 360 walkthrough in the gallery, so you can literally walk into the gallery through Google Street View and kind of poke around. If you don't want to come out and be a little more safe, you can go in and you can find that link at the bottom of my main page on my website. And I'm sure I'll be up to something. I'm counting on it. Yeah, I'm always trying to find a way to be out in front of people. Mm. I like the engagement. I like the connection with others. I like to be a witness to what the work does. It gives it purpose for me. I mean, I feel like it's like a musician who's up there on stage and he looks down and there's that person singing or even those people dancing to it. I love to be a witness to when people dance to my work too.
Well, Rodney, when you and I dreamed this up originally a couple of years ago, and then we were able to start actually developing some episodes. Even though we didn't know it at the time, this is exactly what we wanted to do, isn't it? This is exactly the kind of conversation we wanted to have with exactly this kind of person. So thank you for helping manifest our dream, and thank you for all that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed being with you guys and being on this beautiful property you got, Rodney.
Very special. Well, we'll have you back because now you know how to get here.
I'm not leaving.
Our first rule.
I'm not leaving.
It's beautiful because it's hard to find.
Yeah. How close are you to the Salt Lake? Can we walk?
Oh, not can't walk, but you can walk. Yeah. It's about a 3-minute drive, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The new place.
And the vineyards out there now too. So.
Yeah, that's my next target is to start partnering with the vineyards. If there's any vineyard folks, doing a sort of cultural pop-up exhibits at vineyards where people can engage in the work
sure
that way,
there
too.
Are. Yeah. Well, thank you again for making the time to be with us. And until next time, these are your co-hosts, Dr. Chick Morgan and Rodney Brusseel for Passports, Please. And just remember that great things happen of the mind, the body, the spirit, the heart when you hear the words, Passports, Please. We'd also like to thank our wonderful producer, Brock Glenn Thomas. I don't know why. I've only known him for
I knew you were going to do it.
3 years. That's why we work in teams. I don't know. The two names just sort of roll together.
I know Glenn Brock does actually sound better. Sorry, you got to change it.
Okay, sorry, Brock. And we also want to thank Rupert Neve Design for our studio equipment. They've been very generous with that. And also to Donovan Frankenreiter, who has generously given us our intro and our outro music. So until next time.